Chapter 29. After the award ceremony, Big King's first stop was the recruiting agency office at the entrance to No. 1 Shaft Hostel. There were men clustered about the counter, but they stood aside for Big King, and he acknowledged the courtesy by slapping their backs indiscriminately and greeting them with, "Kunjani, Madoda. How is it, men?" The clerk behind the counter hurried to serve him. Up at the Mine Club, Big King might be a little out of his depth, but here he was treated like a reigning monarch. In two neat bundles, Big King placed the award money on the counter. 25 rand you will send to my senior wife," instructed the clerk, "and 25 rand you will put to my book." Big King was scrupulously fair. Half of all his earnings was remitted to the senior of his four wives, and half was added to the substantial sum already credited in his savings bank passbook. The agency was the procurer of labour for the insatiably man-hungry gold mines of the Witwatersrand and Orange Free State. Its representatives operated across the southern half of the continent, from the swamps and fever lagoons along the Great Zambezi, from among the palm groves fringing the Indian Ocean, out of those simmering plains that the bushmen called the Big Dry, down from the mountains of Basutoland and the grasslands of Swaziland and Zululand, they gathered the Bantu, the men themselves completing the first 50 or 60 miles of the journey on foot. Individuals meeting on a footpath to become pairs, arriving at a little general dealer's store in the bleak scrub desert to find 3 or 4 others already waiting. The arrival of the recruiting truck with 12 men and their luggage aboard. The long, bumping, grinding progress through the bush. The stops at which more men scrambled aboard, until a full truckload of 50 or 60 disembarked at a railway siding in the wilderness. Here, the tiny trickle of humanity joined a stream, and at the first major centre, they transshipped and became part of the great flood that washed towards Goldie. However, once they had reached Johannesburg and been allocated to one of the 60 major gold mines, the agency's obligations towards its recruits were not yet discharged. Between them, the employing mine and the agency must provide each man with employment, training, advice and comfort, maintain contact between him and his family, for very few of them could write, reassure him when he worried that his goats were sick or his wife unfaithful. They must provide a banking and savings service with a personal involvement unknown to any commercial banking institute. They had, in short, to make certain that a man taken from an environment that had not changed in 1,000 years and deposited into the midst of a sophisticated and technological society would retain his health, happiness and sanity, so that at the end of his contract he would return to the place from which he had come and tell them all how wonderful it was at Goldie. He would show them his hard helmet and his new suitcase crammed with clothes, his transistor radio and the little blue book with its printed figures, inflaming them also with the desire to make the pilgrimage and keep the flood washing towards Goldie. Big King completed his business transactions and went in through the gates of the hostel. He was going to take advantage of the fact that he had missed the shift and would be among the first at the ablutions and dining hall. He went down across the lawns to his block. Despite the size of an establishment that housed 6,000 men, the company had tried to make it as attractive as possible. The result was an unusual design, halfway between a motel and an advanced penitentiary. As a senior boss boy, Big King rated a room of his own. An ordinary labourer would share with 5 others. Carefully, Big King brushed down his suit and hung it in the built-in cupboard, wiped down his glossy shoes and racked them. Then, with a towel around his waist, he set off for the ablution block and was irritated to find it already filled with new recruits up from the acclimatization center. Big King ran an appraising eye over their naked bodies and judged that this batch must be nearing the completion of their 8-day acclimatization. They were sleek and shiny, the muscle definition showing clearly through the skin. You could not take a man straight out of his village, probably suffering from malnutrition, and put him down a gold mine to lash and bar and drill in a dry bulb heap of 91 degrees Fahrenheit and 84% relative humidity, without running a serious risk of killing him with heat stroke or exhaustion. Every recruit judged medically fit to work underground went into acclimatization. For 8 days, 8 hours a day, he and hundreds of others stood with only a loincloth about his middle in a vast barn-like hall, stepping up onto and down from a platform. The height of the platform was carefully matched to the man's height and body weight. The speed of his movements was regulated by a flashing panel of lights. The temperature and humidity were controlled at 91 degrees and 84%. Every 10 minutes he was given water, and his body temperature was registered by the half-dozen trained medical assistants in charge of the room. At the end of the 8th day, he emerged as fit as an Olympic athlete, and quite able to perform heavy physical labour in conditions of high temperature and humidity without discomfort or danger. "Guardini," growled the Big King, and the nearest recruit, still white with soap suds, hurriedly vacated his shower with a respectful "Keshle," in deference to Big King's rank and standing. Big King removed his towel and stepped under the shower, reveling, as always, in the rush of hot water over his skin, flexing the great muscles of his arms and chest. The messenger found him there. "King Nakulu, I have word for thee." The man used Shangaan, not the bastard Fanicalo. "Speak," Big King invited, soaping his belly and buttocks. "The Induna bids you call at his house after you have eaten the evening meal." "Tell him I will attend his wishes," said Big King, and held his face up into the rush of steaming water. Dressed in a white open neck shirt and blue slacks, Big King sauntered down to the kitchens. Again the recruits were ahead of him, queuing with bowls in one hand outside the serving hatches. Big King walked past them through the door marked "No Admittance, Staff Only." The kitchens were cavernous, glistening with white porcelain tile and stainless steel cookers and bins that could serve 18,000 hot meals a day. When Big King entered a room, even one as large as this, no one was unaware of his presence. One of the assistant cooks snatched up a bowl, not much smaller than a baby's bath, and hurried across to the nearest stainless steel bin. He opened the lid and looked expectantly at Big King. Big King nodded, and the cook ladled about 2 litres of steaming sugar beans into the bowl, before passing on to the next bin, where he again looked for and obtained Big King's approval. He added an equal quantity of mixed vegetables to the bowl, slammed down the lid, and scampered across to where a second assistant waited with a spade beside yet another bin. The spade was the same as those used for lashing gold reef underground, but the blade of this one had been polished to gleaming cleanliness. The second cook dug into the bin and came up with a spadeful of white maize porridge, cooked stiff as cake, the smell of it as saliva-making as the smell of new bread. This was the staple of Bantu diet. He deposited the spadeful in the bowl. "I am hungry." Big King spoke for the first time. And the second cook dug out another spadeful and added it to the bowl. They passed on to the end of the kitchens, and at their approach, another cook lifted the lid on a pressure cooker the size of a washing machine. From it rose a cloud of fragrant steam. Apologetically, the cook held out his hand, and Big King produced his meat ticket. Meat was the only food that was rationed. Each man was limited to 1 pound of meat a day. The company had long ago discovered, to its astonishment and cost, that a Bantu offered unlimited supplies of fresh meat, was quite capable of eating his own weight of it monthly. Having ascertained that Big King was entitled to his daily pound, the cook proceeded to ladle at least 5 pounds of it into the bowl. "You are my brother," Big King thanked him, and the little procession moved on to where yet another cook was filling a half-gallon jug of thick, gruel-like, mildly alcoholic Bantu beer from one of the multiple spigots beneath the 1,000-gallon tank. The bowl and jug were ceremonially handed to Big King, and he went out onto the covered terraces, where benches and tables were set out for al fresco dining in mild weather. While he ate, the terrace began to fill, for the shift was out of the mine now. Every man who passed his table greeted Big King, but only a few privileged persons took the liberty of seating themselves at the same table. One of them was Joseph McCarty, the little old sweeper from 100 Level. "It has been a good week, King Nakulu." "You say so." Big King was non-committal. "I go now to a meeting with the Old One. Then we shall see." The Old One, the Shangan Induna, lived in a company house, a self-contained residence with lounge and dining room, kitchen and bathroom. He was handsomely paid by the company, provided with servants, food, furniture, and all the other appurtenances of his rank and station. He was the head of the Shangan community on the Sonda Ditch. A chief of the blood, a greybeard, and a member of the tribal councils. In similar houses and with the same privileges and in equal style lived the Indunas of the other tribal groups that made up the labor force of the Sonda Ditch. They were the paternal figureheads, the tribal jurists, ruling and judging within the framework of law and custom. The company could not hope to maintain harmony and order without the assistance of these men. "Baba," Big King greeted his Induna from the doorway of his house, touching the forehead in respect not only for the man, but also for what he represented. "My son," the Induna smiled his greeting, "come and sit by me." He gestured for his servants to leave the room, and Big King went to squat at the feet of the old man. "Is it true you go now to work with the Mad One?" the Induna asked. That was Johnny DeLange's nickname. They talked, the Induna questioning him on 50 matters that affected the welfare of his people. For Big King, this was a comforting and nostalgic experience, for the Induna stood in the place of his father. At last, satisfied, the Induna went on to other matters. "There is a parcel ready tonight. Crooked Leg waits for you." "I shall go for it." "Go in peace, then, my son." On his way through the gates of the hostel, Big King stopped to chat with the guards. These men had the right of search over any person entering or leaving the hostel. Particularly, they were concerned with preventing either women disguised as men or bottles of spirits entering the premises, both of which tended to have a disruptive effect on the community. As an afterthought, They were also instructed to look out for stolen property, entering or leaving. Big King had to ensure that none of them would ever, under any circumstances, take it into his head to search Big King. While he stood at the gates, the last glow of the sunset faded, and the lights began to come on across the valley. The clusters of red aerial warning lights atop the headgears, the massed yellow squares of the hotels, the strings of street lamps, and the isolated pinpricks of the residential areas up on the ridge. When it was truly dark, Big King left the guards and sauntered down the main road, until a bend in the road took him out of their sight. Then Big King left the road and started up the slope. He moved like a night animal, swiftly and with certainty of the path he followed. He passed the ranch-type split levels of the line management officials, with their wide lawns and swimming pools, pausing only once when a dog yapped nearby, then moving on again until he was into the broken rock and rank grass of the upper ridge. He crossed the skyline and started down the far side until he made out the grass-covered mound of rubble in the moonlight. He slowed and moved cautiously forward until he found the rusty barbed wire fence that guarded the entrance. He vaulted it easily and went on into the black mouth of the tunnel. 50 years before, a long-defunct mining company had suspected the existence of a gold reef in this area and had driven prospecting adits into the side of the ridge, exhausting its funds in the process and finally abandoning the network of tunnels in despair. Big King paused long enough to draw an electric torch from his pocket before going on into the tunnel, flashing the beam ahead of him. Soon the air stank of bats, and their wings swished about his head. Unperturbed, Big King went on deeper and deeper into the side of the hill, taking a turning and fork in the tunnel without hesitation. At last, there was a faint glow of yellow light ahead, and Big King switched off his torch. "Crooked Leg," he called. His voice bounced and boomed along the tunnel. There was no reply. "It is I, Big King," he shouted again, and immediately a shadow detached itself from the sidewall and limped towards him, sheathing a wicked-looking knife as it came. "All is ready," the little cripple came to greet him. "Come, I have it here." Crooked Leg had earned his limp and his nickname in a rockfall a dozen years ago. Now he owned and operated the Concession Photographic Studio on the mine property, a flourishing enterprise, for dearly the Bantu love their own image on film. Not, however, as profitable as his nocturnal activities in the abandoned workings beyond the ridge. He led Big King into a small rock chamber lit by a suspended hurricane lantern. Mingled with the bat stench was the acrid reek of sulfuric acid in high concentration. On a wooden trestle table that occupied most of the chamber were earthenware jars, heavy glass bowls, polythene bags, and a variety of shoddy and very obviously second-hand laboratory equipment. In a clear space, amongst all this clutter, stood a large screw-topped bottle. The bottle was filled with a dirty yellow powder. "Ha!" Big King exclaimed his pleasure. "Plenty!" "Yes, it has been a good week," Crooked Leg agreed. Big King picked up the bottle, marvelling once again at the unbelievable weight of it. This was not pure gold, for Crooked Leg's acid reduction methods were crude. But it was at least 16 carats fine. The bottle represented the week's collection of fines and concentrates by men like Joseph McCarty from a dozen vulnerable points along the line of production. In some cases, carried out from the company reduction works itself under the noses of the heavily armed guards. All the men involved in this surreptitious milking off of the company's gold were Shangarns. There was only one man in whom was vested sufficient authority and prestige to prevent the greed and hostility which gold breeds from destroying the whole operation. And that was the Shangarn Induna. There was only one man with the physical presence and necessary command of the Portuguese language to negotiate the disposal of the gold. That was Big King. Big King placed the bottle in his pocket. The weight pulled his clothing out of shape. "Run like a gazelle, Crooked Leg!" And he turned back into the dark tunnel. "Hunt like a leopard, King Nakulu," chuckled the little cripple, as he disappeared into the moving shadows.